Hello there, and welcome to Sounds Like Canada. I'm Catherine Gretzinger. In the meantime, we have got some impressive people to meet right now. Jeffrey Rosenthal, for starters. At 20, he left the University of Toronto with a mathematics degree. At 24, he walked away from Harvard with his PhD. His specialty? Probabilities. Today, he'll talk about his passion for the possible and his new book, Struck by Lightning. We begin today with the luck of the draw. You know, there are times in life where, whether your number has actually come up or not, you feel like you've won a lottery. Say you're celebrating your birthday, you've just published a brand new book, and you're a guest on Sounds Like Canada. What are the odds? Well, luckily for me, Jeffrey Rosenthal is just the man to answer that question. He's a math professor at the University of Toronto, and it is no accident that we are about to talk this morning. His new book is called Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities, and Jeffrey joins me in our Toronto studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
What are the odds that you'd be having a birthday and talking on National Public Radio at the same time?
Well, of course, if you choose any one day and you say, what's the chance that you're having your birthday that day, it's about one chance in 365. But of course, the more guests you have on the show, sooner or later, somebody's going to have their birthday. And I guess it turned out to be me.
I guess you're the first person I've ever spoken to in my life who was born on a Friday the 13th, though.
Yes, I was born on Friday the 13th, but I've had a very lucky life, so I use that to prove that all these superstitions about Friday the 13th are actually nothing to worry about.
What is the probability calculation when you talk about birthdays and figure that into how we get to understand who we are and how we fit into the world?
Right. Well, there's a lot of fun things you can say related to birthdays, but one of the most fun is sometimes called the birthday problem. And it says if you have a group of people in a room, what's the chance that some two of them have the same birthday? And for example, with, let's say, 40 people at a party, you might think, well, there's 365 days in a year and only 40 people here. It's pretty unlikely that some pair of people have the same birthday. But actually, it's about a 90% probability that they do. And the reason is because with 40 people, there's still so many different pairs. There's, you know, A with B or A with C or B with C or B with D. And when you start adding up the pairs, there's actually 780 different possible pairs, even out of 40 people. And that's why it's so likely that some pair have the same birthday. And so it's kind of a fun game, first of all. So if you're at a party and you want to make a little money, you can make a bet with someone and they'll probably say, oh, I bet no two people have the same birthday. And you say, no, I'm willing to bet you. But it also, I think, has implications for the way we kind of view the world. And in particular, when things sort of happen to happen together at the same time. So, you know, you happen to see three people on the same day, each of whom has their hair dyed purple. And you say, you know, that's weird. This must be a new trend. This must have a cosmic significance. Something must be happening. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's just out of all the groups of three people that you could have seen on all the different days that sooner or later something like that was bound to happen.
Tell me, have you always thought about the world in this way?
Well, in some ways, that's a good question. I mean, when I was little, I always loved probabilities, actually. So I always, you know, flipping coins and rolling dice and playing games was always fun for me. But then as I grew up and studied mathematics more seriously, for a while, I'd say I was more focused on the technical side of the subject and, you know, advancing in research and getting a PhD and so on. But only in recent years have I started to think again about just how relevant probability is to everything that happens in life, whether it's whether you'll win the lottery or whether you'll be killed by the terrorists or whether you'll catch your bus or whether if you ask someone out on a date, they'll say yes. And you start thinking all these things that are uncertain. They're all sort of beyond our control. And you think, well, you know, if you're interested in thinking of the world that way and sort of understanding this uncertainty and understanding it, I mean, we can't say exactly what's going to happen, but we can get a sense of things through thinking in terms of probability. And this book that I've written is supposed to emphasize that.
So is it all about us trying to gain some sort of control in a world that sometimes feels chaotic?
Well, yeah, that's certainly a part of it. So, for example, often people are extremely afraid of things because they see in the news, you know, there's been a terrorist strike and they think, oh, my God, it's going to happen to me next. You know, it's inevitable. And just a simple check of the numbers. You can say, you know, how many people were killed in that way by, you know, airplane crashes or by terrorists and so on, compared to how many people die in other ways or how many people are alive. And you start to realize that even these things that sound very scary, it's a very, very small probability that something bad's going to happen to you. And I think that can be comforting. I mean, I used to be a slightly nervous traveler on airplanes. You know, whenever there's a little bit of turbulence, I think, ooh, you know, maybe something's wrong. Let me look out the window and see if the wing looks okay and everything. And at some point, I realized, well, look, there's millions and millions of flights every year and only a very small number that have any sort of a serious problem other than just being late, which happens all the time, but having a serious problem. So then you start to think, well, I'm on this airplane, and even without knowing anything about what's going on out there, it's extremely unlikely that I'm going to have a problem. And yeah, I do think that that's helpful to think that way.
So has it changed the way that you approach flying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now when there's a little bit of turbulence, I maybe think, gee, I hope I don't feel uncomfortable, or I hope the plane isn't late, or I hope I catch my connecting flight. But I no longer think, gee, I hope we don't crash, because I realize that's just so unlikely. It's just not something that I should be worried about.
Now, do you do that when you're standing at a bus stop and somebody lights a cigarette and you know that the bus is going to arrive any minute, or when the sky is blue, you know that it's going to be a sunny day? Do you sort of take it to every extreme?
Well, to some extent. I mean, not obviously all the time, because, of course, nobody thinks about the same thing all the time. But let's say I think more and more, as I think more and more about this, and especially in the course of writing this book and thinking more about how probability relates to things, I've noticed more and more that somehow so many things that come up that are uncertain, you can sort of think about that way. Again, it doesn't necessarily tell you exactly what you should do or exactly what the probabilities are, but it provides the right sort of a framework to think about those uncertainties.
Some of the examples you come up with in the book are a lot of fun to think about. The one that jumped out for me was the tortoise and the hare.
Aha, right. Yeah, so the tortoise and the hare is always one of those fairy tales that annoyed me, and I couldn't put my finger on exactly why, but I guess it has sort of this moral message that, you know, the tortoise is slow and steady, you know, he's not very fast, but he never takes breaks, and that's good, and that's why the hare may be fast, but takes breaks, and, oh, that's bad, you know, that's not the right way to live your life. And I guess part of it is, for me personally, I find sometimes I'm very productive and I get a lot of work done, and other times I might take a day kind of slow. But then I thought, well, what does that mean, sort of, if you think in terms of probabilities? And I realized if you really want to compare a tortoise and a hare, the important thing isn't who's the most steady, but it's who goes the farthest on average. So if the tortoise goes, you know, say, you know, 1 kilometer per hour in a nice steady pace, well, that's okay. But then if the hare goes 10 kilometers an hour half the time and sleeps the other half of the time, the hare is still averaging 5 kilometers an hour, which is still much faster than the tortoise. So sort of thought, if you look at this story right, it should be a story about computing the relative speeds based on the probabilities or the fraction of time that you're productive, not this sort of moral issue about slow and steady. So that's
why
I mentioned
that. But moral is so much easier.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's something to the moral. Of course, you want to, you know, be reliable and get things done. But at the same time, I mean, I guess it comes up for me, especially in the context of the book, it comes up in the context of casinos and things to do with long-run averaging. So I explain how, for example, the casinos always make money, even though any individual person betting, well, some people win and some people lose. But the point of a casino is that the odds are weighted slightly against the player or slightly in favor of the casino. And it means over the long run, with more and more people playing and more bets being made, in the long run, the casino always makes money. And that's why all these provincial governments run casinos in order to fund programs, because they know the casinos are always going to make money, even though some players might win and some players might lose. So I'd say casinos are another example that it's not sort of slow and steady, because sometimes the player wins and sometimes they win. But it's looking at the long run, looking at the long run averages, and I think that's the right way to think about these things.
So, you know, we live in a world full of very smart people, and people know that casinos make a ton of money, and they know that their chances of winning are less than the casino's chances of winning, and yet people still gamble. How come?
Well, it's a good question. Of course, some people actually have gambling addictions, and that can be a very sad thing. I think for a lot of people, it's not as sad as that. It's just that they find it kind of fun and kind of exciting. And also, maybe they sort of think, you know, I'm kind of feeling lucky, or I have a clever system, or I have some way of beating the casino. Now, there's not any way to consistently beat the casino, otherwise they wouldn't make money. But, you know, if you're doing it for entertainment, and I know a lot of people who do, you can think of it as, well, on average, you're going to lose a little bit of money, but you might win money, and maybe it's kind of fun. And it's the same with buying, let's say, a lottery ticket that, you know, the chance of winning the jackpot is actually about one chance in 14 million. Or as I say in the book, another way to think about it is if you have to drive across town to buy your lottery ticket, you're actually more likely to die in an automobile accident while you're going to the store than you are to win the jackpot. So if you think, seriously, I'm hoping to win the jackpot, it's very unlikely. So that's a reason not to buy lottery tickets, and I never do, actually. But some people do, because it's kind of fun and exciting. It's something, you know, when they announce the draw, you get to watch the numbers and see if you've won, and you get to dream. So I think if it's something that you find fun and amusing, that's great. But at the same time, you should understand that the probabilities are weighted against you.
Okay, so what if you are somebody who likes to listen to a lot of music, and you go and buy yourself an iPod, and you've got 1,000 tunes there, and they're supposed to be coming at you randomly, and you're buying into this whole thing because you like the surprise element, and then you're listening for half an hour and you hear the same tune twice.
Yeah, that's right. So that's another fun thing. It's of course, related to the birthday problem that we discussed at the beginning. It says, you know, you're choosing your tunes randomly, how long will it be until you get a match? And so I use an example in the book where you've got to 4,000 tunes. You've really loaded up your iPod or whatever. And yet on the 75th song, you get a repeat. And it turns out that'll happen about half the time. That is, with just 75 songs chosen from 4,000 songs at random, because there's so many pairs of songs. You know, this one can match that one, or that one can match the other one. And there's so many pairs that it's actually about 50% of the time that in the first 75 songs out of 4,000, you'll actually get the same song twice.
Which it makes sense when you explain it like that, but it still is kind of a, you stop yourself when you hear it twice and you think, wow, how could that be?
Well, that's right.
And there it is.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's right. And in fact, I think often people find these things surprising. And as I say, it's the reason you can make money with the birthday problem game, because if you go to a party and you ask people the chance that there's two people with the same birthday, then they'll say it's very unlikely, even if it's actually very likely. The same with matching the songs. And as I say, the same with other coincidences or things that come up that are striking, you know, even things that are more serious, like if there are, say, more than the usual number of homicides in a city in a given week. Then the headlines and say, oh, you know, it's a new rash of murders and crimes out of control, and what should we do? Whereas it could be the same sort of thing, that just by pure chance, out of all the homicides there might be in a given year, just by chance, some of them are going to line up to be in the same week.
How important is it for you as an instructor, as a university professor, to share stories when you're trying to get people to think about where probabilities fit in their lives?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I mean, at the university, I teach at all different levels, of course. And when I'm teaching advanced courses, let's say at the graduate level, then it's pretty much it's sort of the mathematical side of things. And it's just on the technical side, I still try to enliven it as much as I can. But pretty much it's, you know, all the hard and fast mathematics. But there's another side to things. And with this book, what I've tried very hard to do is to not assume any kind of a math background, but just say, you know, you don't need to know all the technical math things. You can still understand the way probabilities fit into so many different aspects of the world. And I think that's a sort of another side of things. But to me, it's a very important side, and becoming more important, I guess, as I think about things more from that perspective. So whereas there's sort of the narrow mathematical technical side of things, which is also very important, but there's also this, how does it fit into the world and how can it help me to think about and maybe explain so many different things that come up? And that's what I'm trying to focus on here.
What are the chances of a person with a mathematical mind like yours becoming an improv comic?
Right. Well, improv comedy is something I've done for about the last decade, just on the side. It's always just been a hobby. And it's something that I've enjoyed a lot. So unlike, for example, stand-up comedy, where you sort of plan everything out very carefully and go over it again and again and rehearse it, with improv comedy, it's all spontaneous. So usually you get a suggestion from the audience, and then just you and your fellow improvisers have to create a scene and create an interesting situation and interesting characters and hopefully make it amusing and interesting just on the spot. And when it works well, which it does more often than you might think, it's a lot of fun. And first of all, you're really working with a team, so that's kind of exciting. And also, you're really sort of creating things as you go, and it's something that I find exciting and something that's in some ways helped me in other aspects of my life too. For example, when I teach now, when I first started teaching, you know, if something went wrong, you know, there was a disturbance or a noise or somebody got up or whatever, I'd be a little flustered and, oh, gee, things aren't right. What should I do now? But with my training in improv comedy, now I can kind of go with the flow more and I can kind of make it into something fun and I can make a joke out of it and sort of keep on top of things rather than being flustered.
You sound as interested in control as you do in chaos and as comfortable on both sides of the coin.
You have to watch it when you say both sides of the coin to a probabilist.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Tell me. Why does the coin seem to land on heads more often than tails?
That's interesting you say that. I mean, in truth, for the most part, coins are 50-50 to land on heads and tails. You could argue it's not quite exactly 50-50 because of the actual shape of the coin and so on, but pretty much it's very close to 50-50. It's true that people often think different things. One thing is often people, once you get any sort of a thought in your head, whether you think coins come up heads more than tails, or you think, you know, on Friday the 13th, you're going to have a bad luck or anything like that, then after that, you tend to remember those events which reinforce your stereotype or what you thought. So if you believe coins come up heads a lot, then you're going to remember all the time someone flipped a coin and it came up heads, and you're not going to remember as much the time someone flipped a coin and it came up tails. And we call that a biased observation. That is, you're just observing or you're just remembering the ones that reinforce your stereotype. But with coins, of course, there's other things that one can say. And one thing you can say is, well, if you flip a coin a bunch of times, like let's say 1,000 times, how many heads will you get? Well, it'll usually be about half heads, so it might be about 500. But it's not going to be exactly 500. And in fact, it might be, let's say, you know, 530, or it might be 481 or something. And that's related to what we call margins of error in, for example, in polls, opinion polls. And in an opinion poll, usually, you know, they'll sample a segment of the population, maybe 1,000 people, and they'll report what fraction of that 1,000 people felt a certain way. But there's always some margin of error, and it's just like with the coin, that the fraction that you sample won't be exactly the same as the true fraction or the true probability. And margins of error, which I discuss in the book too, are very interesting that way, and they give us a new perspective, not just on polls, but on other things. We can say some things are going to happen exactly the way you expected them to. Other things, maybe there's a lot of variability. Sometimes the bus will be really early, and sometimes it'll be really late, and so on. And it's good to understand that too, understand how much uncertainty there is in things.
So did Sammy Sosa cork his bat?
Right. The Sammy Sosa incident was a fun thing that I thought about while writing this book. So as I'm sure most of your listeners will know, he was a great baseball hitter. And then one time he broke a bat and there were pieces of cork that were found in the debris. And he said, oh, it was just a mistake. It's, you know, it's never happened before. And then the question was that the truth? It was just this one time only mistake? Or was it something he was doing a lot and hadn't gotten caught before?
What are the chances
that
this big hitter could only have used a cork bat once?
Well, that's right. That's the question. And it's, you know, if he really was telling the truth, it should be it just happened this one time and he just happened to get caught. But then you say, well, he happened to break the bat that one time. So what's the chance that, you know, the one time, or not the one time, but one of the, let's say, few times, relatively speaking, that he broke a bat, what's the chance that that happened to be the one time that he'd made a mistake and used cork? And I discuss that in the book, and I end up concluding that it's on the order, if a cork bat breaks the same as a regular bat, then it's on the order of about 4%, which is actually pretty unlikely that that was really the only time. But what I also say in his defense, in addition to, you know, they say he seemed to be an honorable person and he cooperated with the investigation and all the other bats in his locker that they investigated all turned out to be fine. So that's in his favor. But what also could be in his favor is that it seems likely to me that a bat that has been corked is maybe more likely to break. And if you believe that, you say, oh, okay, well, once you cork it, you sort of mess it up and it might be more likely to break. I don't actually know if that's true, and I don't know if people studied that or not. But if it is true, then that could work in his favor. He could say, well, I only did it this one time, but because it was corked, it was actually more likely to break. So I use that as an example of the kind of way that, let's say, a probabilist might think about something like that in terms of what are the probabilities and how do they affect each other.
Jeffrey, do you give yourself a bit of a break and say, okay, there are swaths of my life that I will not calculate in probabilities?
Sure. I mean, of course, I don't think about probabilities all the time, and I try to take time off. But it's funny how I have an example in the book of how, you know, even when you're really trying to relax, probabilities come back to get you. So one time I took a vacation with my wife, and we went north of Toronto to a winter resort in the middle of winter, and they had an outdoor hot tub, and it was beautiful white snow, and it was a steamy hot tub, and we're sitting there having a great time, and I noticed that in the water they have one of those chemical dispensers floating around,
no.
And you know, I say that's interesting. It's just floating free, and that's the way they usually work. And why do they do that? Well, because they want the chemicals to sort of spread out evenly around the whole tub. And if it was fixed in any one place, it'd only put the chemicals on one side. So if it's free, then just by the laws of randomness, it gets pushed around here and there, and eventually it sort of fairly evenly distributes the chemicals. And I thought, well, that's it. Even if I'm on a winter vacation in a hot tub in the middle of the snow,
with your beautiful
there's probability.
Wife.
With my beautiful wife. I looked at her too, but I also looked at the chemical dispenser.
Oh my goodness. Where do you go from here now that you've sort of looked at this in such a broad way? Are you going to pursue something a little bit more specific with regard to probabilities, or will you try something completely different?
Well, of course, I mean, my research specialty is also probabilities, so I'm continuing to do research into what are called Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithms, which are a way to use probabilities in computer programs to try to compute big complicated things that are too hard to compute without randomness. So that's a bit of a mouthful. But so I'm continuing with that, and of course with my teaching and so on. But I am definitely thinking more and more in terms of how probabilities relate to so many things. And there's so many different things that I do explore in the book. And you know, I'm certainly, now that the book's out, I'm getting questions and discussion about a lot of them. And I think there's a lot of things that could be pursued more deeply. And I'm just sort of seeing how things develop as far as that goes. And meanwhile, I'm trying to catch up on the university business that I had to put off a little bit while I was finishing the book.
Well, there's such a fascination, I think, for people to understand mathematics in a way that applies to their real lives. And it's a great way to sort of draw people in. People who might otherwise be a little bit nervous about talking about or thinking about mathematics.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's been my goal throughout writing this book, is to say, you know, look, the people who already want to specialize in math, you know, I already work with them, I already teach them, I've already written some textbooks for them. What about everybody else, which is most people? And so this book, you're supposed to not need any math background. It's supposed to be, you know, entertaining and fun, have lots of little stories and vignettes. And the idea is that you just by accident, as you read it, you actually also learn how to think about probabilities and how they fit into the world. And so my hope is, as you say, that people who would never have dreamed of, you know, reading a book about mathematics or enrolling in a class about mathematics, they might say, hey, this is a fun book to read, and at the same time, it gives me more of an understanding.
Now, you've got a little quiz at the back of the book that people can take about their probability, their ways of figuring their way through. Do you have a probability perspective?
That's right. I seem
to answer D on a lot of your questions.
That's right. Well, I didn't want to scare anybody off, so I have to admit I made that. I call it the final exam of the book, but I must admit I made it a little easier than my exams at the university. So it's true that the answer to every question is D, but hopefully it's a way to reinforce what you've already read in the book, and also hopefully answers A, B, and C will be fun and amusing, even though not the true answer.
Now, I said happy birthday at the beginning. How old are you today?
I am 38 years old today.
Okay, and so what do you calculate as being your next big achievement in life and the probabilities of achieving that goal?
Well, that's hard. It's always hard when you're just finishing one thing to know what your next thing is. As I say, right now I'm in a bit of a catch-up mode at the university and busy with teaching and so on, and also, of course, with things related to media and outreach to do with this book. And basically, at this point, I'm looking to talk to as many people as possible, and that's why I'm so thrilled to be on your show and to know that the CVC is back, and what more could I ask for on my birthday? And also, just, you know, the more I'm talking to people, I'm seeing what things people are most interested in and what things I want to explain more and pursue more. And it's very exciting for me, actually, to talk to people like you and your listeners who, as you say, wouldn't normally think about mathematics and probabilities, but here's a chance to bridge the divide.
Do you have 100% probability of blowing out candles at some point during today?
Good question. Probably we'll figure out something. Actually, on Thanksgiving, we combined Thanksgiving celebrations from a few days ago, which also happened to be my wedding anniversary. It was on Thanksgiving, so there's another little coincidence for you. And we had a family gathering, and we had some candles for anniversary and birthday and book and everything else.
Well, congratulations on all of it. It was a real treat to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Jeffrey Rosenthal, he's the author of a really neat new book called Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities, published by HarperCollins.